From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Earlier this month, the Supreme Court upheld a regulation prohibiting federally funded family planning clinics from giving information about abortions. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the plaintiff, Dr. Irving Rust, medical director of a Planned Parenthood clinic in the South Bronx. Also, we meet actor Kevin Spacey. He was bad guy Mel Prophet in the TV series Wise Guy, and he played Jim Baker in the made-for-TV movie. He stars as Clarence Darrow in an upcoming American Playhouse film. And we have reviews of the new movie Soap Dish and two new TV series, Norman Lear's Sunday Dinner and David Attenborough's Trials of Life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The leaders of Angola's government and UNITA rebel group has signed a peace treaty in Lisbon today. The agreement is intended to end a 16-year-old civil war that devastated that country. A provisional ceasefire has been in effect for more than 2 weeks. On Saturday, the last Cuban troops left the Southwest African nation. The Angolan president, José Eduardo dos Santos, and UNITA rebel leader Jonas Savimbi signed the accords. The plan sets elections for the fall of 1992. President Bush met this morning with Soviet emissary Yevgeny Primakov to discuss the Soviet Union's program for economic reform. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Primakov was sent as a personal envoy of Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. After their meeting this morning, President Bush declined to say he favors inviting Gorbachev to July's economic summit in London, but said he has a lot to consider.
More positive on a wide array of specific questions. And yet, that isn't to suggest that there are not some big problems out there.
Earlier, Primakov said he expected the Bush administration will extend most favored nation trade status to the Soviet Union. When asked what the Soviets need from the West, he replied, patience first, then understanding second. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Secretary of Defense has arrived in Egypt for meetings with top Egyptian officials. Lori Neff reports it is the Secretary's first visit to Cairo since the end of the Gulf War.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says his discussions with Egyptian President Mubarak and Defense Minister Tantawi will include President Bush's Middle East arms control initiative. Egypt has welcomed the plan, which includes a call for a freeze on nuclear weapons programs. However, Cairo says all countries in the region must join in the effort, an apparent reference to Israel, believed the only Middle East nation with a developed nuclear arms capability. The talks will also cover security arrangements for the Gulf region. Egypt was a key member of the anti-Iraq coalition, and Egyptian forces sent to the Gulf were supposed to remain in the region to form the core of an Arab security force. But Cairo announced last month Egyptian troops would be withdrawn from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait because their task had been accomplished. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
UN Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar said today that Iraq would have to forfeit 30% of its future oil profits to pay war reparations to victims. Under a Security Council resolution adopted on April 13th, Secretary General Pérez was to recommend a price ceiling that Iraq might have to pay each time it sells a barrel of oil. The United States had suggested between 40 and 50% of oil revenues. Kuwait's losses, however, are estimated at about $60 billion. Saudi Arabia has high costs for beginning to clean up the Persian Gulf, and workers who fled Kuwait after the invasion are expected to file claims for lost wages. On Wall Street, stocks closed at a record high at 3,027. This is NPR. A Colombian newspaper says middle-ranking members of the Medellin cocaine cartel will surrender to authorities before cartel chief Pablo Escobar keeps a pledge to give himself up. The paper said the first surrender had been planned for Saturday, but it was put off because a prison to hold the drug traffickers wasn't finished yet. Iowa is expecting its wettest spring in 99 years, keeping many farmers out of their fields. Eric Niclamo with member station WSUI has this report.
Rain across Iowa for March, April, and May has averaged almost 15 inches. That's nearly 40% above normal. More than 6 inches of rain fell last weekend in parts of Iowa, and Governor Terry Branstad wants Agriculture Secretary Ed Madigan to declare nearly half the state a disaster area because rain and floods have delayed planting. A federal declaration would open the door for low-interest loans and exempt farmers from some federal requirements. 2 more inches of rain dosed Des Moines and central Iowa today, and more is expected early next week. For National Public Radio, I'm Eric Niclimo in Iowa City.
A federal appeals court has ordered a new trial for Robert Wallach, the friend of former Attorney General Ed Meese. Wallach was convicted of racketeering in the WedTech Corporation scandal. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reversed Wallach's conviction because a key prosecution witness admitted after the trial that he lied on the witness stand. Wallach had been convicted of taking more than $400,000 in illegal payments from WedTech. The space shuttle Columbia is gearing up for launch tomorrow at 8 a.m. Eastern Time for a 9-day mission. Columbia is set to rocket into space with a crew of 730 rats and nearly 2,500 baby jellyfish. The flight is to be one of the most detailed studies ever of how the body responds to the loss of gravity. Four of the astronauts will spend the mission as human guinea pigs. They'll be stuck, probed, exercised, and tested all throughout the mission. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people on both sides of the abortion issue think that this month's Supreme Court ruling has brought the court one step closer to overturning Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion in 1973. On May 23rd, the Supreme Court upheld a federal regulation that bars federally financed family planning clinics from discussing abortion with their patients. Even if the pregnancy is life-threatening to the woman, a counselor at a federally funded clinic is not allowed to mention abortion as an option or to refer the patient elsewhere for abortion counseling. My guest, Dr. Irving Rust, was the primary plaintiff in the case. He's the medical director of a Planned Parenthood clinic in the South Bronx. The clinic provides family planning counseling and prenatal care. It has a well baby clinic, a sexually transmitted disease program, and in a branch of the center that receives no federal funds, it provides abortions. We invited Dr. Rust to talk with us about what it was like to be represented in a Supreme Court case. Planned Parenthood and the ACLU asked him to be the plaintiff. I asked Dr. Rust if there was ever any debate about whether the plaintiff in this case should be a woman.
No, I don't think so. I'm the medical director of the Planned Parenthood clinic. And I'm an Afro-American physician. I don't think that it had to be particularly a woman to make this particular case. It's like with on both sides. If you have empathy, you don't necessarily have to be a woman. I have great empathy for women. I come out of a community. I grew up in Harlem. I came out of a community of Black and Hispanic women. My parents were of that mix. And so I have great empathy for women and for poor people. And I come out of a poor background. So I feel that I was as good a plaintiff as any, even not being a female.
Have you performed abortions yourself?
Yes, I have. And I've delivered babies. That question was asked to me recently on a radio program. How do you feel about abortions? Well, let me explain something to you. I did my residency in New York in 1965 to 1968, prior to abortions being illegal. During that period of time, women were dying and near death when I was a resident, a young physician at Lincoln and Jacoby Hospital in the Bronx. And I saw all of the horror stories that you can imagine. People have forgotten that period of time. So what I'm trying to explain to you is that I feel that a woman has to make her own decision. Once she makes that decision, then with abortions being legal, and the reason they became legal was because of these thousands of women who died and were near death during these early days prior to abortions becoming legal. So I feel very strongly that what I'm doing is not killing people, but I'm helping to save lives. I'm helping to save women's lives, which I had to do prior to this period of time when abortions became legal.
Dr. Rust, could you tell us what, for you, was the high point and low point of the Supreme Court trial?
Well, the high point was just coming into the Supreme Court to see the American system work, to have this case go all the way up to the Supreme Court, to sit there and watch the nine justices and to hear the system work. As you know, the case was developed by a brilliant young lawyer named Rachel Pine at the American Civil Liberties Union, and then Dr. Lawrence Tribe, Professor Tribe of Harvard, came in and presented it before the Supreme Court. It is an inspiring position to sit there and hear the arguments and to see men like Marshall up there, who I admire very greatly, and to see, you know, the liberals that I felt were important to the court. I'm sorry the court has become conservative. And that I feel that the decision is a poor decision that I think eventually will be turned around. The low point was that I thought we might win the case, and I was disappointed when I heard David Souter, the new justice, point several pointed questions at the Solicitor General, Kenneth Starr. I thought he might be, you know, liberal. He might think a certain way, but of course I was wrong, and I was disappointed and really quite shocked at the decision.
I'm interested in your comments on some of the judge's rulings. Judge Rehnquist, who supported the decision, he was in the majority. He basically said, if government doesn't have to pay for abortion for poor women, it would strain logic to force it to pay for abortion counseling.
Yeah, well, you know, Judge Rehnquist is basically saying that we're not changing anything. A woman would be able to get all the rights under the situation. The only thing is preventing her is being indigent and poor. Well, what he's basically saying is that we've got two systems of medical care in our country, one for poor people and one for rich people. And in my mind, a government, a democratic government, the purpose of government is to raise people up, especially in our particular situation. We have so many problems. And the major problem of the country right now, is economics, the poverty. We're being devastated. People are being devastated in this country by problems of poverty. And all of the women I work with are poor. I see this every day. They have a myriad of problems. And to place this, another barrier in their way, to me is abominable. I'm just terribly devastated, and I just feel so badly for my clients and my patients.
Do you have any regrets about taking this to the Supreme Court? After all, now you've ended up setting a precedent that many consider a setback not only to the pro-choice movement, but to civil liberties in general.
No, I don't consider a setback. When you see a wrong, you've got to attack it, whether you win or right or lose. So it's not a matter of you know. Recently, as you know, I'm an Afro-American physician. Louis Sullivan is an Afro-American physician. Well, when black men get to the position of power, they have a responsibility when they walk the halls of power. They have a responsibility to look back and help, you know, the people that they come from. So I think that by fighting for what I believe in, even though I lose or we lose, it's worth the fight. You can never say don't fight because you're going to lose. You know, that's a chance you have to take.
Does the pro-choice movement feel that there is any recourse now to prevent this regulation from going into effect?
Well, no, I don't think they feel there's any choice now from it going into effect. I think what's going to happen is that organizations like mine have made the decision, like Planned Parenthood New York and Planned Parenthood General, have made the decision that we will not go along with this and we will not accept the funds, that we cannot be gagged. Other organizations which receive money, I think, will have to sit down with their boards and their staff and make a choice of decision. I'm hoping that most of them will do what we do, but I'm not sure. It's a hard choice to make when you need money. Do you accept a little money and give some care, or accept no money and give no care? Our budget is about 18 to 20, in the range of 18 to 20-some percent for the Bronx. We're going to try to make it up by cutting back in certain areas, and hopefully it will we'll be able to survive, and we'll be able to not cut back too much on our care for our patients. Obviously, there's going to be somewhere where we're going to be hurt, and some of our patients are going to not get the full care that we were usually giving them.
Dr. West, do you think that some clinics will have to close if they give back federal funds?
Yes, I do. I think that's one of the problems. And that's what's going to be the decision. Whether if you have to close, is it better to stay open and give some care and not give full rights, or is it better to stay open and give us, you know, some of it? I think that's going to be a hard choice for a lot of the of these clinics, a really hard choice. And I'm so sad for that because, you know, it's nice to stand on moral grounds, but sometimes it just kills you to do that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Irving Rust. He was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court case Rust versus Sullivan, and the decision upheld a ruling that prohibits federally funded family planning centers from discussing abortion with their patients. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Irving Rust is my guest. He's the head of a Planned Parenthood clinic in the South Bronx, and he was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court case on abortion, Rust versus Sullivan. Do you think that patients coming into your clinic would know about the Supreme Court ruling, and if, for instance, you were abiding by that ruling and withholding information about abortion, do you think that they'd know why?
No. I'm not putting down my patients, but people have problems. They're not medically sophisticated. They don't read the New York Times or the Washington Post and all the, you know, the papers that tell you all about Supreme Court decisions. But when they come in, they have trust in us. We have a fine clinic, I think the finest clinic in the Bronx. And we have a good rapport and a lot of confidence. And how can anyone, to have someone come into you and say, doctor, I'm considering abortions. What should I do? What do you think about it? Have I got a right to it? And they're saying that, our patients are very sophisticated. They know where they can go. Well, I know that many of my patients are not sophisticated. And they don't know where to go. Sometimes I get a young girl that comes in, it's 14 or 15 years old, and she's already 12, 13 weeks pregnant. I said, well, why didn't you come in here before? She said, well, I didn't know where to go. It happens continually to me and to our staff.
Well, can you give us a sense of the range of reasons that the women at your clinic sometimes opt for abortion?
Oh, God, I mean, it can be so many things. First place, they make a mistake. A young kid has her first couple of sexual encounters and gets pregnant and doesn't want to leave school. Can you imagine here, you have a poor black Hispanic kid who gets pregnant. Now, her chances of ever getting to Harvard and Yale are completely remote. But she might make it with some luck, you know, to the City University, to John Jay College. Well, we're eliminating that chance completely. She won't be able to join the mainstream of our society. Some women come in and they make the choice because they're breaking up with their husband, or they have a poor relationship with their husband, or they have five or six or seven kids and they can't have another the kid, economically or psychologically or emotionally. I mean, how can I tell a woman, yes, these are your, we understand that, but I'm going to refer you for prenatal care, whatever your problems are. Well, you know she's not going to. You know, I've worked with women, I told you back, all the way back in the 60s, I know women will make their, whatever economic status they come from, they will make their own decisions about their own body. It's the most individualistic thing that we have, the most important right that we have, and no one's going to take it away from them. Me, the Congress can help them. The president can't take it away. The Supreme can't take it. They're not going to let it happen. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to give the best medical care I can to protect these women, and that's what I think my job is.
Dr. Rust, were you a practicing physician during the period when abortion was illegal?
Yes, I was. And I've delivered, let me just tell you, I never did a legal abortion, but I delivered thousands of babies. It's the most beautiful thing for an obstetrician to deliver babies. I wish this was the real world, was everyone was happy, everyone had the perfect marriages, that all babies that came in the world were wanted. But that's not the real world we live in. And you know it, and I know it, and everybody out there should know it. Abortions are not an enjoyable thing to do, believe me, and I don't do it with any joy. But I know it's a necessity, and it has to be done. If not, you're going to have a lot of women that are going to be dead and dying again.
How did you handle the question of abortion when it was illegal to get one or to give one?
Well, you know, when I was a resident, even at that period of time, the changes started to take place. What happened when I was a resident at Jacobian and Lincoln Hospital, what happened is that we had small committees that started in the hospital. You would have a psychiatrist, an internist, a hospital administrator, and an OBGYN man. And they would talk over a woman who would make an appeal for an abortion. They would talk over her needs. And if the needs were met, you know, the New York State allowed you to do an abortion at that period of time. That was in the late 60s, just prior to the decision. So it had started even at that period of time where they realized that something had to be done or women were going to continue to hurt themselves and kill themselves in trying to get an abortion.
What made you eligible for a legal abortion in that period?
Oh, psychiatric. You said that you were going to hurt yourself or you were going to commit suicide or that you were so emotionally distraught that your family was falling apart. You had some kind of medical problem like diabetes or hypertension that would put yourself at risk for another long term pregnancy to term. Those are the kind of things that we had to make judgments on at that time.
I don't know if you'd feel comfortable discussing this or not, but I'm wondering if you knew at the time of doctors who performed abortions illegally who you felt you could recommend patients to.
Well, let me just tell you. I never recommended patients for abortions, but most of my professors who were all white at the time, I'm just trying to bring that out because the wealthy women who were white at the particular time were all sent by their private doctors, and all my professors were had private practices. You know, they taught us in the hospital as part of their health. Helping young physicians, but all of the professors sent their patients on airplanes to Puerto Rico, Mexico, or not Cuba, because Cuba obtains, but they used to send them to Cuba. So every woman who wanted an abortion, who was wealthy, could get on an airplane sent by their private physician to Puerto Rico or Mexico and get it done well, get it done. It wasn't legal, but it was done without, because you were paying a lot of money, it was done safely. So I remember those days. By the time I got out, the law had just about changed. I was 2 years before I was in practice, and I didn't perform any abortions, and I was just building up a practice. So I didn't have an opportunity to send anybody or to refer anybody for an illegal abortion.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Irving Rust, and he was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court case Rust versus Sullivan, and this is the case that was just decided on last week, and the Supreme Court ruled to uphold a ruling that prevents federally funded family planning clinics from giving out any information about abortion. So what do you see happening in the near future at your Planned Parenthood clinic, the one that you direct? You're going to give back federal funding so that you don't
Well, we won't give it back. We just won't accept it because we've been paid up until recently. So
I see.
Well, we won't be giving any money back. From what I understand, we have 30 to 60 days, and they will ask us to sign a form that we will follow the regulations. We will not sign the regulations, and then obviously they will cut off the funds for the future. So I think as of 60 days from the day of the decision, we will no longer be receiving funds. Our program, we have a great program for our students upstairs. We have a two-level clinic. We have a learning program for our students. I regret that, but I have a feeling that will be cut back somewhat, our teaching program. I think we're going to try to cut back on all different levels and not hurt any one program completely. I'm hoping that we'll be able to meet most of the needs, although I know it's not going to be complete.
Let me ask you, what's to prevent a clinic that opposes this ruling from taking federal money and still talking about abortion with their patients?
You know, and I know that what the government is going to do and what the right to lifers are going to do is they're going to send people in there to test it. They're going to send someone in who's pregnant and ask if I want an abortion, can I have it? And if you said yes, you can go here or you can go there or we do abortions here, then they would attack you. We feel that's somewhat dishonest. We should stand on our principles and that we should say we're not going to accept the money and we're not going to be dishonest about it. That's the other side, and I don't think we should play their game.
Tell me on a personal level why you don't feel you could uphold this regulation, why you feel you couldn't deal with a patient and not mention abortion if you felt it was relevant to their need.
Terry, I have 4 children. That's what my family and my wife decided we wanted. I wanted more. She didn't want any more. For me to have said to her or to any woman, I want you to go for prenatal care, how can I apply different standards for my own standards that I would have for myself? In other words, Justice Scalia has 14 children. Fine. He's a Catholic. Beautiful. That's what he wants for himself. Fine. If a person comes in and they want something for themselves, how can I honestly, as a doctor, beside being a doctor, how can I not give her what she wants? How can I put my demands, my thinking on her life? I don't go home with her at night. I don't know what her life is like. She knows what her life is like. So how can I personally put my demands on her?
So tell me what you think of the legal system now. I mean, not very many people in this country end up being the plaintiff in a Supreme Court case. You're one of those few people, and you lost.
Yes.
Give me your impressions now about the Supreme Court. You know, I don't mean the specific justices in it, but how the system works from your perspective, from one of those few people who actually was represented in the case.
The system works, but the problem is that the system works better for some people than other people. I think the Supreme Court is going to lose a lot of its prestige in this particular situation. Not just this case, but I think, you know, we usually say our nation is a nation of laws and not of men. Well, when you really look at it, it's really men making the laws. So when you bend those laws to the way you want them to be bent and not look at the moral issues, you lose credibility. And I think the Supreme Court, I think the government in these particular situations will lose a great deal of credibility. And I think it will pull down the visual of the court being a staunch last bastion of rights. And I think you're going to see that in the future. Linda Greenhouse wrote an article in the New York Times Week of Review. She's a law correspondent of the New York Times. And she said that this is an activist court. This court is trying to turn back all of the changes that took place during the Warren administration, tenure of the Supreme Court. And I think what you're going to see is that period of time we had great respect for the court. We knew that they were on the side of poor people, of blacks, of Hispanics, of the little guy in our country, you know. Well, I think that you're going to see that go. And I think the respect is going to hurt the court and the government terribly. And I'm sorry for that because they should be the ones out there helping it. It helps the nation for us to go forward. It uplifts us to help the poor person. It doesn't help to push them farther down.
On a personal level, how do you feel about having your name now a part of American legal history?
Well, you know, I'm a sort of a buff, a history buff. I had thought about becoming a history teacher. And my family and I are tickled pink. My wife's family has a background of American history. One of her ancestors was a slave spy. Her name was Sarah Bowser. So our family is really tickled that we have it on both sides of our family. We're in the American history books, and we're really tickled pink. And I'm particularly tickled pink to be part of American history. It's nice. It's part of Americana, and I'm glad to, you know, be part of that.
Dr. Rust, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry, for having me.
Dr. Irving Rust, Medical Director of the Planned Parenthood Center in the South Bronx. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. TV is often too formulaic to be conducive to offbeat performances, but Kevin Spacey was acclaimed for his electric portrayal of bad guy Mel Profit on the series Wise Guy. Since then, Spacey has played Jim Baker in a made-for-TV movie, and he'll soon portray Clarence Darrow on public TV's American Playhouse. Coming up, we meet Kevin Spacey. Also, TV critic David Bianculli tells us about two new series, one by Norman Lear and the other by David Attenborough. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Soap Dish, the new comedy starring Kevin Kline, Sally Field, and Whoopi Goldberg. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar has decided that Iraq should pay up to 30% of its oil revenues in the future to a war reparations fund. NPR's Jim Zaroli has more on that story.
Under the Gulf War ceasefire resolution, Perez de Cuellar was charged with determining how much of its oil revenues Iraq should pay to victims of the Gulf War. Today, a spokesman for the Secretary General said he had set a ceiling of 30%. The spokesman said the figure would leave Iraq enough money to pay its pre-war debts and import the food and material goods it needs. The 30% figure is about what analysts had been expecting and represents a compromise between various Security Council members. The U.S. had been advocating a figure of up to 50%, while some non-aligned countries had argued for as little as 5%. The issue of Iraqi reparations payment is somewhat hypothetical right now, since Iraq is still bound by a trade embargo that prevents it from selling oil. That embargo won't be lifted until Iraq turns over its weapons of mass destruction. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Secretary of State James Baker will meet tomorrow with Syria's foreign minister in another effort toward a Middle Eastern peace conference. Baker is in Lisbon for ceremonies marking the end of 16 years of civil war in Angola. Baker so far has been unable to overcome differences of procedure between Israel and Syria over the format for peace talks. An independent commission that's considering closures and cutbacks at U.S. military bases around the country announced today that 36 more installations have been added to the list. NPR's Corey Flintoff has a report.
The 36 new names will be considered along with 43 others already targeted by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney as sites that may be shut down or scaled back. The Defense Base Closure and Realignment Commission stressed that the added names are only options and that the list was designed to alert people whose communities may be affected. Commission spokesman James Walker also had good news for communities whose bases were not named.
We wanted to cap it at this point. And to say that in 91, if you are not on this list or on the Pentagon's list, you are, for 91, out of harm's way.
The commission will meet to narrow the combined lists on June 6th. They must present their final recommendations to the president by July 1st. I'm Corey Flintoff in Washington.
A huge explosion at an army arsenal in northern Pakistan has killed at least 3 people. A number of other people were injured. The blast knocked out all electrical power in the city and most of the telephone lines. The Dow Jones Industrials closed at a record high of 3,027.50 after moving up over 26 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. After a White House meeting with Soviet officials, President Bush said today that he feels more positive about a Soviet request for Western aid. Moscow officials said that they expect Mr. Bush to ease trade restrictions on Moscow and perhaps approve $1.5 billion more in grain sale credits. The president also said that he has not yet made up his mind as to whether Soviet leader Gorbachev should be invited to a financial summit meeting in London this summer. Final launch preparations are underway at the Kennedy Space Center for a space shuttle liftoff tomorrow. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Officials with the nation's space agency say everything is go for tomorrow morning's planned liftoff of the Space Shuttle Columbia. Workers are scheduled to begin loading the shuttle's fuel about midnight Eastern time. That could be delayed slightly, however, as heavy thunderstorms roll through the Cape Canaveral area. Forecasters say there's a 60% chance that the weather will cooperate by tomorrow morning's launch time of 8 a.m. Eastern time. Columbia and her 7-member crew will spend 9 days in orbit conducting medical research on each other. This Space Lab Life Sciences mission is designed to further enhance knowledge about how the human body adapts to microgravity. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
A 3-judge panel in St. Louis heard arguments today on the sale of 3 London air routes by TWA to American Airlines. Both the City of St. Louis and unions at TWA are fighting the sale. Attorneys for the city argued that the transfer could eventually cost St. Louis close to $2 billion a year, along with a loss of some 23,000 jobs. The two airlines have already closed the sale. But the transfer of the air routes does not take place until the 1st of July. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sunday night at 8, 2 new TV series will be competing for viewers' attention, Norman Lear's Sunday Dinner on CBS and David Attenborough's Trials of Life, a nature series on TNT cable. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
I'll get right to the point. I've seen all 12 hours of The Trials of Life, and it's great. The best documentary series I've seen on TV since PBS's The Civil War. I've also seen the first 4 episodes of Sunday Dinner, and it's lousy. The choice is yours, and it's easy. Sunday Dinner is being sold as the series with which Norman Lear, who created All in the Family, steps into the 90s. Once again, he's aiming for controversy and looking closely at family life. In Sunday Dinner, Robert Loggia plays Ben, a widower who marries a woman who's young enough to be his daughter. In fact, 2 of his daughters are her age or older, and like their younger brother, they don't think much of Daddy's new bride. But the real controversy in Sunday Dinner is that the new bride, played by Terry Hatcher, is devoutly religious. She prays to God, out loud, in speeches that sound like this.
Chief, you got a minute? Oh, this wonderful man you sent me. I love him so much. And he's got this terrific family that he loves so much. Well, I know I'm really gonna love them, and oh, maybe someday, please, they'll even love me. But right now, I am scared to death. And that's not all.
You don't really need to hear any more, do you? The problem with Sunday Dinner is that Lear, who wrote the pilot, is using all the same tricks as before. Extended monologues, silly malaprops, intentionally controversial topics. But what was innovative in the 70s doesn't necessarily work in the 90s, and Lear is apparently unaware of how much better and funnier sitcoms have gotten since he was at his peak. David Attenborough, on the other hand, just keeps making his shows better and better. Life on Earth and The Living Planet were wonderful, but Trials of Life, his new show, is so amazing, so beautiful, so fascinating, and so much flat-out fun that you have to see it. And tape it if you can, because it's a definite keeper. The whole series is about behavior that most animals have in common. Being born, eating, surviving, attracting a mate, perpetuating the species. Attenborough takes us on a worldwide nature walk, and he's terrific. Sometimes he's even like a documentary Dr. Doolittle, talking with the animals using their own languages. In one scene, he communicates with fireflies by using a flashlight and the right sequence of flashes. In another scene, he pounds the ground with his fist to talk to a rodent in what might be described as a true rap session.
This is a geophone. Basically, it's just a device which turns vibrations in the ground into sound, which I can hear and record on this. And with it, maybe I can have an underground conversation. That's my message. And there's a reply. The animal's not hearing sound, it's just responding to vibrations in the ground. I'm talking to a mole rat.
I can't rave about this series enough. You'll see things you probably never saw before and won't soon forget. Killer whales intentionally beaching themselves to catch and kill baby seals. A mean-spirited bird stealing from and vandalizing a nearby nest. Incredible deep-sea jellyfish with psychedelic light shows built into their tentacles. And on and on and on. Each episode contains wonders too numerous to describe and too good to miss. Remember, Trials of Life runs Sunday through Friday, 8 to 10 p.m. on TNT. It's a classic. As for Sunday dinner, well, it hasn't got a prayer.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Coming up, an interview with actor Kevin Spacey. This is Fresh Air. The Tony Awards are Sunday, and my guest Kevin Spacey is up for Best Featured Actor for his performance in Neil Simon's play Lost in Yonkers. Spacey has also been acclaimed for his performance in Jonathan Miller's production of Long Day's Journey Into Night, which also starred Jack Lemmon. But most of us know Spacey from TV. He was televangelist Jim Baker in a recent made-for-TV movie about Jim and Tammy Faye. Next Friday on most public TV stations, you can see him as the celebrated lawyer Clarence Darrow in the American Playhouse production Darrow. I'm one of the Spacey fans who first saw him in the TV series Wise Guy. He played bad guy Mel Profit, a twisted drug dealer and corrupt businessman with a thing for his sister. Here he is pulling a gun on the hero of the series, undercover federal agent Vinny Terranova.
Do you like roulette? One round, six chambers.
Come on, Mr. Profit, I think maybe you got a nose full. Don't do this.
Not cocaine. Rule one, don't inhale the retail. What I take is medicine, Jack. Prescribed PX formulas. Dr. Feelgood's number 9. It doesn't put me to sleep, but it makes me feel a whole lot better.
Round and round she goes. Where she stops, nobody knows.
You've done theater and movies, but really, I think you're like your breakthrough role in terms of public recognition was on Wise Guy, in the role of Mel Profit. Did you expect that would happen on TV?
One of the reasons that Wise Guy intrigued me, both as a character and then in terms of how we approached it, was I felt that I'd watched so many actors play bad guys as sort of slick and antiseptic and kind of cool and in control, that because Mel was so bizarre as a character, that when you're playing a character like that, the parameters are much wider. You can get away with a lot more. I felt that if we could approach it almost with total abandon, which isn't done all that much on television, certainly in series television. And as I say, I must give credit to Steve Cannell and David Burke because they really gave not just me, but the whole a company up there in Vancouver, we were there for about 6 months, a sense of complete freedom.
You've said that you wanted to meet with Cannell before taking the role, and you wanted to tell him that you wanted to slowly build the character, and that it might not be clear right from the start what you were doing.
Well, yeah, Stephen didn't understand. I turned down the show at first, and Stephen didn't understand, you know, who this young pup, virtually unknown New York stage actor was turning down a major role on a primetime series. He just couldn't figure me. So he thought, well, and Steve is a very smart and intuitive man, and he said, well, will he come in and talk to me? And I said, sure. So I went in that night. This all, by the way, happened in about 12 hours. I went in that night after I'd met him in the afternoon originally, and we sat and we talked for an hour. And I'd had a couple of experiences doing episodics as a guest, and they weren't very good experiences. And while I thought that I might be able to do something, I was afraid that the same kind of conditions would be at play on this show.
What kind of conditions?
Well, a lot of times if you're a guest on a TV series, you find that, in particular if you're not known, if you're starting out, you find that there's a lot of line producers who sort of stand behind the camera asking a lot of questions about why is his hair like that, or why is he wearing that tie? What's he doing with his face? Why doesn't he just play it the way God? And it becomes very confining as an actor to have someone there who is not necessarily artistically inclined making decisions and judgments. And on Wise Guy, because I felt that the character, I thought this isn't going to be something that I walk on the set on the first day and decide how to play. This is something that I want to have evolve and grow over these 7 episodes, and it ended up being 9 in the end. But I thought I said to Stephen in this meeting, I said, if you let me do what I think I can do with this role, you're going to think that you have an actor who's completely lost his mind as you watch the dailies, which are what they watch every day of the film that you've shot, because it won't make sense to you, and it might not even make sense in totality, but I think we'll be able to do something that will be interesting and unique.
I'm interested in finding out a little bit about you. You were born in New Jersey, but you grew up in Los Angeles. Tell us something about your childhood. Why did your parents move? What did they do?
My father was a technical procedure writer, and he worked for corporations as diverse as Rockwell. And what that means is, very briefly, the guys who put together the F-16, they have to put it together with a manual, and my father wrote that kind of manual, not the F-16 in particular, but as an example. And my mother was a private secretary. She worked at Busch Gardens out in California for a number of years.
Busch Gardens, oh boy.
Yeah.
Did you go there a lot?
Are you kidding? I had more Budweiser sweaters than I can count.
Oh boy. I've always figured, you know, you can't afford to go to Europe, but you can go to Busch Gardens.
That's right. That's right. And I started I went to school out there. We moved around quite a lot. I think it's one of the reasons why I feel at home wherever I go, because we moved so much that I had to make wherever I went in my new home. And I started a theater in junior high school. A guidance counselor suggested that I take a drama course, and I did, and they can't stop me yet.
Have you ever been very brash or aggressive about getting a part or getting an audition?
Extremely. I would not have done Long Day's Journey and Tonight with Mr. Lemon had I not taken no for an answer. When that play was being cast, the people who were casting it didn't feel I was right for it and wouldn't see me for about 8 months. So I finally went to a series of lectures that Dr. Jonathan Miller was giving stole my way into a party in his honor and got enough courage to sit in a chair next to him at one point and talked for about an hour and convinced him to see me for the part. And I did. 2 days later, I had my first audition, and he cast me. And that was in 1985, and I hadn't done really anything up to that point that merited me getting that role, except I'd done my work in preparing for it over those 8 months. And it was really, for me, a breakthrough experience.
What were some of the things you told him when you got his attention that you think convinced him to give you an audition?
I think basically he understood what I had been going through in terms of trying to get an audition. I think there are you know, sometimes people in this business, in this industry, who think that directors want big stars and big names for parts, and when in fact they're just really looking for the best actor for it. And so sometimes it's hard to get over those hurdles, and I think he just saw in my eyes and understood the struggle that I'd gone through in trying to get an audition and was sympathetic to it. We had also talked for at least a good 40 minutes before I ever even brought up Long Day's Journey. I just got to know him a little bit and chatted, and I think out of that as well was what he decided to give me a shot.
Did you ever do stand-up comedy? I think I'd read that about you.
Yeah, you've done your work here. Yeah, I did, in California, actually. I did stand-up comedy for about a year and a half in clubs and bowling alleys. Wherever.
Bowling alleys?
Oh, unbelievable. And let me tell you, when you're doing your best material and there's not a peep, and then you hear the sound of bowling pins being knocked over, it's really so encouraging.
Well, I don't know if you'd really find your audience at a bowling alley.
Boy, I'll tell you. Well, at the time, I was doing an imitation of Johnny Carson in my act, and I realized that people who were at bowling alleys for midnight talent contests don't watch Johnny Carson, so they had no idea who I was doing. They were absolutely clueless.
What other stuff did you do?
I did a lot of topical material. I even actually, somewhere on tape, ABC did a pilot for a series called The Comedians, which was something that they'd done in Granada Television, done in England. And I hosted it as Johnny Carson. And somewhere there's a tape of this thing that we did in 1978. I was just out of high school. And occasionally, for benefits and things, I'll bring Carson out again because he's so much fun to do. And and he's difficult to do. I find a lot of comedians who I watch do him do a very sort of high profile Carson. It's very high comedy. They're impressionists who have to be identified. Their characters have to be identified in the first 10 seconds. And I approached Carson a little bit like an actor. I went sort of underneath, and in fact, I was gonna do. I did the Carson show last year when we promoted the Jim and Tammy movie, and it was a big thrill to do the show because I used to hang out at the Tonight Show and watch him live almost for an entire summer to learn how to do him. I didn't get a chance that night to do him because I ended up only having 3 minutes, but they promised the next time I'm on that Johnny and I will meet. and you know what? Nobody will care. It'll be a weird thing, but...
Oh, yeah. So why did you give up comedy and go into acting? Was that your plan all along?
It really wasn't a plan so much as it was just the way things turned out. A friend of mine had come to New York and attended Juilliard and had been encouraging me through letters to, if I was really serious about acting, I should come and audition. And I finally did and was accepted. And I think I just decided that I think I understand why actors, why people like Robin Williams and Steve Martin, Billy Crystal, have gone out of stand-up comedy and ended up becoming actors. I think because stand-up comedy has so many limits to it that as a performer you just ultimately feel that you need to break out of it. I mean, I was never in their league by any measure, but I understand the idea of wanting to. And I was always an actor. Stand-up was sort of a sidelight, but it was ultimately an incredible experience and absolutely terrifying.
Well, you're doing a comedy now. You're still on Broadway with Neil Simon, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Yes.
So you're getting his laughs.
I'm getting Neil's laughs. That's right. And they're much better than the laughs I was getting, I'll tell you, because Neil can write. It's great fun, this play, Lost in Yonkers. I actually, when I was in high school, the last award I ever won was for a fall drama festival where I did a monologue from Neil Simon's The Gingerbread Lady. So Neil's been very good to me, and it's nice to be doing his material again. It's also exciting to create a role for the first time. This is a first for me in Broadway. Hurley Burley I replaced in, and Long Days, of course, was a revival. So it's very exciting to play a role that nobody else has played and sort of get a first whack at it.
Well, Kevin Spacey, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Actor Kevin Spacey, this is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. I'll talk with an attorney in Addis Ababa about the week's developments in Ethiopia, the change in leadership there after the civil war. He explains about his fear that over the long history of Ethiopia, emperors, it seems, always need to have enemies and are therefore prone to start wars. A conversation with Franjo Tudjman, the president of Yugoslavia's Republic of Croatia. His republic, he says, will become independent by June 30th if a compromise isn't reached with the other Yugoslav republics, and the Croatians are prepared to fight for their independence. Also, we'll talk with Dennis Smith, a longtime firefighter in New York, and get his review of the new film, Backdraft.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie Soap Dish, starring Kevin Kline and Sally Field, opens this weekend. The screenplay was written by Robert Harling, who adapted the play Steel Magnolias for the screen, and Andrew Bergman, who last wrote and directed The Freshman. Stephen Schiff has this review.
It's taken a long time for Kevin Kline to turn into the movie star he was always meant to be. After making a name for himself as a swashbuckling stage hero, he made his screen debut in the lugubrious Sophie's Choice. And then for ages he was sober, straight, matter-of-fact, a regular leading man, which is not, it turns out, what he was meant to be at all. It took A Fish Called Wanda, and now Soap Dish, to reveal that Kevin Kline is one of the funniest comic actors we have. In Soap Dish, he plays a washed-up soap star, a former player on the daytime drama The Sun Also Sets. His co-star was Sally Field, but they had an affair. It went on the rocks, and now he's been sent to Siberia, by which I mean a dinner theater in Florida. Now the producer of The Sun Also Sets, a manic yuppie played by Robert Downey Jr., wants to bring him back. He's hoping that Kline's return to the show will drive Sally Field off it, which will satisfy her chief rival, played by Kathy Moriarty, who in turn will reward Downey with a role in the hay. Got it? You don't have to. All you really have to know is that when Kline is on the screen, Soap Dish is heaven. And when he's not, well, it's a pretty mixed bag. And when the appalling Sally Field is on with him, well, is the glass half full or half empty? Here they are having at each other after their first reunion scene in The Sun Also Sets.
Things are hard for me right now, in life and on the show, okay?
Things were hard for me 20 years ago when you spat me out and left me for dead.
And you're back to return the favor. That's what this is, some kind of revenge thing.
Oh, don't flatter yourself. I'm here for me. I got a chance at a career, and I'm not going to blow it this time. I'm not going back to Florida, no how. You tried playing Willie Loman in front of a bunch of old farts eating meatloaf, chewing and slurping and spitting out their pits. Every night listening to them coughing and hocking and retching. I was in hell, consigned there by you.
What happened to your career was not my fault.
That's not how I see it.
If I hurt you, I'm really sorry. I was very young.
Not anymore, babe.
Klein is a tricky actor. He has a way of disguising the hugeness of his performance until it's ballooned to such an expanse that you suddenly notice it's about to flatten you in your seat. And even then, he won't stop tickling. There's a scene near the end of this movie in which he has some difficulty with a teleprompter that'll have you weeping with laughter. The trouble is, that scene is preceded by 6 or 7 utterly tiresome ones. Soap Dish, it turns out, is 2 movies in one. Call them Soap and Dish. In Soap, the screenwriter Robert Harling decides it'd be funny to make a movie about a daytime TV cast whose real life is even more soap operatic than the one they play on TV. Swell, except that the real lives he invents for them aren't funny. They're turgid and inane, just like, well, a soap opera. So now the producers realize they have a premise but no follow-through. The solution? They hire Andrew Bergman to write in some Dish. And everything he writes is hilarious. Soap, Dish. Dreary and funny at the same time. Of course, all of this would be so much easier to take if it weren't for Sally Field, who has spent the last 20 years on a weird trajectory. First Gidget, then, hey, a surprisingly skilled actress. Then, well, kind of a corny skilled actress. And now a real movie wrecker. Everything she does in Soap Dish is overwrought, grating, inauthentic. What puzzles me is the way the unraveling of her talent was timed. Is it just coincidence that the moment she told us all that we loved her, was exactly when we stopped?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Sherrock, Robbie Harris, and Sue Spolin. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we consider what cemeteries have to tell us about the living. And we talk with British actress Billie Whitelaw about her recent movie The Craze and her work with the late Samuel Beckett. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.